a moment of panic that nearly verged into anger at the start. This evening we're going to carry on with this second in the series on our baggage check of our righteousness that Ian started this morning. And I think I said last time, you know, people ring you up and they say, will you speak on such and such a day? And you look in your diary and you go, yeah, fine, no problem. Then they ring you up and they tell you what they've given you. And you go, yeah, no problem. Because you think you know what it is. And you go and open it. And then panic sets in. And I looked at this and I read the verses. And you think, well, 9 verses, not very long. And then you find a book. And you find that somebody writes something like 34 pages on the first 6 verses of those 9. And then writes something like 60 pages on the last 8 of them. And you think, and it's an evening service with 15 to 20 minutes as the sort of allotted time. So where do we go? And I've got one answer. If you read from verse 21 to verse 30, and you look at me, I am it. I am those verses. And in all fairness, I can say to most of you, if you're honest, you are those verses. They are us, where we are in everyday life. Ian explained this morning that the point of these verses are to take the commandment and in fact make it personal. The Jews had a whole army of people who expanded every one of the laws of the Ten Commandments into massive tomes, you know, about the minutest detail. You shouldn't labour. So what is labour? You know, it's a small amount of honey enough to salve a wound. To pick up that amount of honey on a Sunday is labour. And that was the detail they went into. But when it came to thou shalt not kill, that was simple. They didn't tell you how you might kill somebody or how you might not kill somebody. It was left as thou shalt not kill. And in these first few verses, Jesus actually says to us, this is what I really want it to mean to you as individuals. To make it personal. And verse 22 makes it plain to us that anger is the beginning. And from a small anger, if you can say there is such a thing as a small anger, everything grows. And ultimately, murder can be the consequence of that act of anger, that feeling. And that doesn't mesh with modern day society. Sociologists have written a list of things that we're entitled to be angry about. According to them, and this particular sociologist I read, you can get angry when you feel frustrated, when you're disheartened, when you're hurt, when you're attacked, when you're oppressed, when you're exploited, when you're manipulated, when you feel cheated, when your needs have not been met. Get angry about it. Demand your needs are met. Demand your rights. When you're feeling let down and when you're feeling rejected. According to them, we have a right to be angry. Do we? Jesus is telling us here to be careful of anger. And sometimes we'll say, if looks could kill, because we can see the emotion in somebody's face. And for some of us, it's hard. Lots of you know me well enough, and you go, we don't need you to say anything wrong, your face says it all. And I have this at work. They say to me, you don't have to say anything. We know what you're thinking. But that's how some of us are. And for some of us, when we get angry, it shows in our faces. And that anger can be a slow-burning one that's built up over a long period of time. It's been fueled like a fire. And it's instant. Other ones are instant. How many of us sit in a traffic jam on a Monday morning and go, you stupid, get out of my way. shouting at the person in front because they've turned right when they're indicating left. We're all capable of anger in one way or another. But when we do that tomorrow morning in our cars, do we actually sit there and think, oh, I've just broken the sixth commandment? No. Because we take it, until this point, we've taken it that thou shalt not commit murder. And Jesus is reminding us that the thoughts of our minds and the thoughts of our hearts, which is where anger comes from, is at the root of all of these situations. So is all anger wrong? If we take that literally, we say yes. But we know from Scripture that it's not, because Jesus showed righteous anger. We can all think of the instance in the temple where he got angry about his father's house being used for the money changers, for corruption. And in Matthew 21:21, we hear that story of where he goes into a rage and throws the tables over. In Matthew 23:17, he calls the Pharisees blind fools. And in Mark 3:1-6, he actually looked at them in anger. So his face showed his anger. And I was thinking about this, that what can this be saying to us as individuals in the church about our anger? And I think it's because anger destroys. And often the kind of anger that we see is one that comes from resentment, from rejection. And it starts off as a little bit of anger. And because we don't deal with it, it grows and it grows and it grows. And in several of the books I read, it's referred to as Gehenna anger. Now, Gehenna was actually used as a reference sometimes to hell, because Gehenna was the rubbish tip of Jerusalem, and it was located in the Valley of Hinnom. And this rubbish tip burned every day of every week of every year. It never went out. It smouldered. It grew. It glowed at night. And then it would combust. Now, nowadays, we know that it probably combusted because methane gas was being generated, and you get the problem we get on our landfill sites. But for the Israelites, for the Jewish nation, the people who lived around Jerusalem, it was used as an indication of what hell was going to be like. And that's what that kind of anger does. It festers, it grows. And so often we hang on to things and they grow and they fester. So what does Jesus actually say to us to do about this anger that we have? Verse 23 and 25, it's very simple. Face up to it and deal with it. That sounds easy. We say, well, you're angry about something, deal with it. Go away and deal with it. Pure anger, take it with you. Go somewhere else and do it. But it's not. Because often our anger hurts people. It hurts people we love. It hurts people around us. And more importantly, it hurts us. Because it cuts us off. It actually stops us being in relationship with people. And it makes them turn away. Because we're not a nice person to be around if we're always angry. And Jesus is very clear about the consequences. And it's quite a frightening way he puts it. That not only does it cut us off from other people, it cuts us off from God. He talks about our offering not being acceptable to God. In another reference I read, it talks about our worship not being acceptable to God if we're angry about something. That's a real challenge, isn't it? Because I don't know about you, I get uptight about things. I overreact, I get angry, And I carry them around for days sometimes. I just want to, as I said at the beginning, I think that I want to make this personal because, as I said to Ian, this that I rushed home to get was version 3 and you nearly got the unprompted version 4. But I just wanted to give you two examples that I've experienced. And there's probably 4 of you here, 5 of you who will remember, 6 of you that will probably remember this one. Believe it or not, I was an angry young man one time. And Jill and I asked Jill the question today, can you remember why I was angry that time? And she said no. So God's taken that away and dealt with it. But something had happened between us, and I got so angry, I flew into a rage and pushed my fist straight through a wall in our house. No, I hasten to add, it was a plasterboard wall, not a brick wall, but there was a hole in the wall. And we left it there for months, just as a reminder of what I was capable of when I became angry. And a long time afterwards, Malcolm Franks was speaking at Mighton Church. And Malcolm said, will you come and tell that story? Will you tell people how you felt and what made you react like that? And we didn't know what the outcome would be. But over a 2 to 3 week period, I either had people come and speak to me or ring me up. There must have been 12 or 15 men out of that congregation who were facing up to that same kind of anger. The violent, explosive anger that has to be dealt with. Now, I'm not saying there's a prescriptive way of dealing with it. I'm just saying that for us, it was to leave that hole in the wall as a reminder. But we have to deal with it as individuals and as the people we live with and work with and share our lives with, which means the church. The other one was when I had a visit from someone in the church I thought was a very close friend. And he came and told me that his wife hadn't taken communion for several weeks because she was angry with me because of something I'd said. And if I was at church, she wouldn't take communion. Now that was a hard conversation to have, because I couldn't even remember the last time I spoke to this lady. The harder conversation was when he said, will you come and say sorry for what you said? We find it hard to say sorry when we know what we're apologising for and saying sorry for. But I tell you that as hard as that meeting and that conversation was, the smile on her face at the end of it was worth it more than anything else I could think of. And it's taking that step. She had to take the step to share it with her husband. He had to take the step to come and talk to me about it. And then we both had to go and take the step and go back again. But it's dealing with the anger, even if we don't know where it's come from. And that was a good example of what Jesus is saying about our anger cutting us off from him, in our fellowship with him, in our worship of him, in our service. And it returns that we don't actually get his love back either. We cut ourselves off from that. And now we come to the second part, which deals with the 7th commandment, thou shalt not commit adultery. Here again, the Jewish interpretation was very clear. It was committing the physical act. Again, there was no prescriptive rules about which bit was right, which bit was wrong or not. It was simply that you committed adultery. And it was a very narrow interpretation, because it meant that they basically ignored the 10th commandment. thou shalt not covet your neighbor's wife. They were separating them out, when in fact many of them are linked together and relate to each other. And so Jesus opens this passage up again, and he does it in just three verses, from verse 27 to 30. And he wants us to not only just understand that the commandment says, thou shalt not commit adultery, but he wants us to understand what leads to that act of adultery. And it's nothing new. It wasn't new when the commandments were given, it's not new now, and it wasn't new for Job. Job in chapter 31 verse 1 writes, I made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a girl. Job knew what it was like for him. And it's exactly the same for us. Job wasn't saying, I'm not going to look at a beautiful woman and appreciate her for her beauty. Job was saying, I'm going to look at her and appreciate her for her beauty, but not let my mind and my heart take it further. And so that's the same for each one of us. And for us in our society, it can't be just looking at a beautiful person. It can be what we look at on television, what we read, what we listen to, what we see. In our society, it can even be the advertising hoardings around us as we go and to and from work. There's a whole raft of things which are trying to undermine how we should be thinking. And I remember, again, years ago, Kim preaching on this. And I remember being quite shocked when Kim, I think it was even in this building, stood here and said, you don't have to reach to the top shelf and pick up that book and take it home. Just the thought that you've looked at it and it's gone through your mind that you might pick it up and take it home is enough. And that, again, is a challenge. And although a lot of this seems to be male-orientated, I would say, ladies, it applies to you. There are books out there which are aimed at the ladies, but they're not on the top shelf. They're on the middle shelf, and they're amongst all the glossy magazines that ladies like to pick up and buy. And it's the article, it's the odd set of pictures, it can be anything. So it applies to all of us. But I think it does apply, and again it's personal, it applies to us men in a slightly different way sometimes. There's a number of us in this church, the number of us here tonight, who have to go away on business. And the temptations when you're away on business are greater. We looked earlier on in this series at being salt and light. Yeah, I was in Prague recently. We go for a meal. We have a very nice meal. And then the lads go, oh, we're all going off to a bar. And we know that it's a naked lady dancing bar. What do we do when we're in that situation? We're with people who we work with every day. We're going to be with them the next morning. They may be clients who are spending a vast amount of money with us. What do we do? Do we say, yeah, okay, I can go along and have a drink, I can basically put the shutters down, I won't take any of it in? Or do we say, okay guys, it's not for me, I'm going back to the hotel? What's the choice we make? And we get back to the hotel and we switch the telly on, and the first thing it says, adult movies, £9.95. Shown on your bill as normal film. There's decisions to be made. You see what I'm getting at? It's not a straight, cut and dry thing. The temptations are there all the time. And it's how we deal with them. And as an encouragement, I say in those situations, often, we're not the only people who don't want to go to that place. number of times where I've found myself recently in that situation. I say, well, sorry, guys, it's not for me. And two or three other men have said, oh, are you going back to the hotel or we'll join you for a drink? Because you've given them, almost like giving them an excuse and a get-out clause. And if we don't take that stand, they go along. And so there is that responsibility on us, on how we react and how we deal with it. So how do we deal with it? What do we do? Well, the first thing is we can learn a lesson off Job. Job made a covenant with God to protect him and to guard him and to show him how to live his life. One of the things I found very encouraging early on was a Christian guy who said to me, find somebody who you trust. It doesn't have to be a friend. He just has to be a Christian you trust implicitly. So that when you have a problem like this, you can go and you can talk to them, you can share it, they can counsel you, they can pray with you, and they won't go and tell anybody else what you've said. And some people say, well, I can do that on my own. But we can't. Having somebody there to help and counsel us is a good thing. And after that, again, we take note about the things we read, the things we watch, the things we see. Do we fill our minds with that? Or do we actually fill our minds with the right things? And eventually, we get one thing that we have to do, and we may have to do at some stage, and that is run away. It happened to Joseph. He was being stalked. He was being sexually harassed. You can put all the modern day spin on it you like. But he chose to run and flee. And there may be situations for each one of us where we have to flee. We have to leave that situation. And it may be that it's somebody in the office who's getting too friendly. It may be a situation with somebody we seem to be spending too much time with. But we need to see it. We need to react to it. And we need to do something about it. And ultimately, taking ourselves out of that situation is the final one. And the other bit of good advice I had, and I've read it a couple of times this last couple of weeks now, and this was, and again it applies to ladies or gents, if you find that you are having the wrong kind of thoughts about a lady or a gentleman, then pray for them. But it's impossible to pray to God about an individual that you're having the wrong thoughts about. So that's the real answer, is to pray for them, not necessarily for yourself, but by praying for them, you're changing your perception of them. You're changing your attitude to them. And finally, when we fail, which we will, in a thought, in our mind, in our heart, whatever it is, we will fail at some time. What do we do next? We remember the prodigal son. We do as he did. We turn back to God. We ask for his forgiveness. He won't turn us away. We repent. We accept the forgiveness that Christ purchased for us by his death. And we learn from the experience. We move on and we go forward. Thank you.